720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me, as ever. Lots to do on the show today. We're going to be talking a little bit about some of those big changes we've seen to the Twitter platform. A lot of people have a lot of opinions about those, so we're going to be talking about them. And we're going to take a look at... there is a type of restaurant that is perhaps diminishing a bit. It's disappearing a bit here in Chicago. And so we're going to take a look at that and look at what remains of Jewish deli culture in Chicago. But before we do all of that, there is a really, really interesting story that is in Washington Post. It was written by Aaron Gregg, who is a reporter there, and who wrote about there's this really fascinating lawsuit. And when we're looking at the very quickly changing media landscape, just recently here in Chicago, we saw that impact DNA Info. We see this happen a lot. We see quick changes to the media landscape. But this is a really fascinating story about a blogger that is being hit with this threat of a lawsuit that is really quite interesting and complicated. It reads almost like a soap opera, but here to break it down for us, please welcome to the program, Aaron Gregg. Thanks for being with us today, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I got a bit tongue-tied introducing this story even because it's so complicated and so interesting, but it really does kind of read like a soap opera.
It's a head scratcher for sure. So, basically, the background here is that DCS was shut down last week, as we've all know. DNA Info is parent company of DCS, and acquired that blog, didn't found it, but acquired it through a merger. But what's happened here is that this guy Aaron Myers, who actually is not a full time journalist, he's actually a jazz singer who does jazz shows all around DC area. If you're active in that community, you definitely know him. He just decided, I'm really mad about this, and I'm going to start a blog called DC Is Now, which pretty close to the DC Is domain name, but he basically decided, I don't care if they own the trademark. I'm going to do this anyway, and, that's it.
Right, right. And DCist, of course, for people, who aren't familiar, perhaps, we're in the realm here of like Chicagoist, Gothamist, all of those, that realm of, of website. And DCist, of course, super popular. But yeah, anytime you maybe add now to a name that is trademarked, you're probably going to get a little bit of pushback, certainly. And this gets into, or at least the allegation here is that it's getting into violating anti-cyber squatting Consumer Protection Acts. That is one that we don't discuss often, but when it comes up, I for some reason, whenever it comes up, it's always an interesting story attached to it. It always seems like a really strange act that only comes up in unusual circumstances.
Yes. Well, it's an absurd word applied to absurd circumstances like this.
Well put, right. And so talk us through that that law a little bit for those who might not be familiar.
Sure. So basically what cyber squatting is where you squat on a domain name that is not yours legally. So Ricketts and DNA Info are basically alleging that because they own the brand of DCist, and they have, according to their letter, they've built goodwill through that brand, although lately it doesn't seem like a lot of goodwill, right, thrown at them over this. But anyway, they're basically saying, we own that brand and you are piggybacking off of our brand, and so we're going to sue you for $100,000.
And so how far along has this case gotten, and what is the kind of the sentiment of it right now as far as how you think it's going to shake out?
So this is just at the very early stages. There haven't even been any formal papers filed yet. All we've seen is a cease and desist letter sent to Aaron Myers. After I saw that he had started this site, I literally just flagged him down in the middle of sets in his jazz show. And he said, yeah, I got the cease and desist letter. He said, I'm not going to back down. He's basically said, I don't have any money and there's not much they can take from me, so I might as well just hold my ground for the people of DC. So, to be honest with you, it's hard to imagine that he has too strong of a case, given that there's like three letters separating the two
right
names. And yeah. And he says in the blog, like, I'm doing this to replace Decius, but he is utterly determined not to back down, even though, you know, we're talking about pretty hefty fees here for a musician that admittedly cannot pay them.
Right. Yeah. When we think about journalism and jazz musicians, it's probably not real high up there on the pay scale.
No.
Two professions no one gets into for the money, certainly. And so, is this a solo act? Is he doing this all on his own, or is he or does he have other bloggers working with him on this?
No. He's that's the thing about this guy, is he's a very adept community organizer within the jazz community. And so he knows a lot of people around town, knows a lot of these local journalists that, you know, cover these things and write about them and puts these events together. So he's last time I checked the site, there were a fair amount of people from, you know, Washington City Paper and other local publications who are doing guest blogs on this. He's not paying them yet, however, which I think is going to be a limitation for the ability of Decius now, even if the lawsuit is thrown out. I think that's going to limit their ability to really do anything, because the reason Decius was so great was they had these full-time journalists who were really busy all the time and were everywhere, and they had their bills paid by Joe Ricketts' company. Aaron Myers isn't doing that, at least not yet.
Right. Well, you do have to admire his stance on the whole thing. Like, you know what? You can't get blood from a turnip. I might as well, you know, go all in here and see what happens. So I suppose the brazenness
exactly.
is a bit admirable. But it'll be interesting to see how this continues to unfold, to see how far exactly this goes. But we will keep turning to you at Washington Post for the latest on this. So thanks.
I appreciate that.
Thanks so much for being with us today, Aaron Gregg.
Of course. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay. So we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about perhaps is Jewish deli culture vanishing in Chicago? Many things to discuss there. Many types of sandwiches and soups to discuss along with it. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to do on the program today. After the 12:30 news, we're going to be talking all about some of those big changes that have come to the Twitter platform, because a lot of people have some mighty strong opinions about those changes. So we're going to be talking all about that with an expert. But before we do that, there is a really, really interesting and fun story that is in the Chicago Tribune right now. It is by Louisa Chu, who is a reporter at the Tribune. And it is all about the perhaps vanishing Jewish deli culture in Chicago. Louisa, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday with us.
Thank you so much, Amy. I really appreciate it.
So talk us through this story. This really grabbed my eye. I was a big fan of Steve's Deli and mourned its loss very, very deeply when it closed its doors, even though it has rebooted and it's a perfectly fine establishment now. I read the story with great interest. And so what sparked this story initially for you?
Well, it's part of our new reader question series where we invite readers to submit a question, and then our editors might let us reporters go out to report the story. So this came in from a reader named Susan Wolf, and she had a question about where she could find a good corned beef and chicken soup in the Gold Coast area. Kind of simple. And answering that question for her Gotteson Grocer in the Gold Coast has not only really good corned beef, but they also have a Mile High Reuben plus chicken soup, including every single day matzo ball soup. But when I talked to the reader more, it turned out that she was really asking about what happened to all the Jewish delis, you know, the really big Jewish deli culture that seemed so prevalent here in Chicago. And so then I went on a quest. And luckily, my editors let me have the freedom and patience to go to, you know, we talk about Chicago not really being a deli town, a lot of people, but I went to currently 19 different places and ate 20 different sandwiches, mostly corned beef, some pastrami, plus one pastrami spiced trout, and discovered that not only is there still an amazing Jewish deli culture, but it's actually transforming into what they call the new restaurants, newish delis.
The newish, I like that.
Right.
and so what, when you're looking at the newish delis, what is the key difference of them? How are they rebooted?
They include kind of more of international influences. For example, one of the first is Steingold over in North Center on Irving Park. And they have not only the classic sandwiches with corned beef and pastrami, but they're the place that I had the pastrami spiced trout. And he also actually has what he calls a sister-in-law sandwich, which is actually a nod to his actual sister-in-law that includes not only the smoked meats, but kimchi. And it's kind of makes sense when you think of sauerkraut and kimchi. It's sort of all sort of the same family.
Sure.
And yeah, and so it's kind of amazing how there's really that transformation. There's actually a few other ones that just opened after my story came out, plus there's a few more coming up. So there's actually quite a big movement towards that too.
So plenty, just perhaps well hidden.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because you think I keep hearing again is that people can, oh, Chicago's not a deli town. But like I said, I heard from a lot of people who wondered why I didn't go to, for example, the Bagel. I did go to the Bagel. I went to the location in Old Orchard, which is actually, huge and mm-hmm. older than the location that's in Lakeview and has a history that dates back to 1950. But it didn't make the story itself since it was kind of focused on this reader's question. And I wish I could have mentioned every single one, because there were so many that were so influential. Plus, I also went to 11 City Diner, which is kind of bridged between the older deli and the newer deli, not quite old and not quite newish, and has that location that's in the South Loop area and had the second location up in Lincoln Park as well. And so they're there. They're here.
Yeah.
And so I think it's maybe because a lot of people – understandably, like you had their favorite deli that they loved going to with their family, maybe when they grew up, or and maybe it's closed or changed, and so maybe people feel that loss and kind of feel like, oh, delis are gone. They're not gone. They're definitely here.
They're here. We're just overlooking them. Well, I'm glad you mentioned 11 City, because 11 City is an interesting one in particular because it is newish, but it puts so much effort into looking like the classic. It looks vintage and so charming inside.
Exactly. Everything from when you first walk in, there's a candy counter on one side, and there's actual deli counter, which a lot of these Jewish-style delis don't actually have a deli counter, which used to be really important as part of not only the culture, but actually identifying it as a deli, as well as then, don't get me started about Jewish and kosher-style foods, because that's a whole other area, too.
Right, whole other show.
Yep, exactly.
Right.
Maybe station. absolutely. They have the older style, but they have cocktails too. So definitely kind of, bridges that gap as well.
Certainly, certainly. And of course, I was very happy to see that Manny's made that list. I feel like that's a go-to for so many people. That's one of those, even when you don't live near it anymore, you find a way back down there to visit Manny's.
For sure. Manny's is maybe our most famous iconic deli now, and also has a history that dates back actually to Greektown. But they themselves didn't actually open their deli counter until just last year. They celebrated their 75th anniversary this year. But even though insiders knew you could buy stuff by the pound, they didn't actually add that counter in until just recently, plus expanded, even though it does look, I think, looks pretty nice and old but new. Some people kind of lament it, but what are you going to do?
Right. The only downside of Manny's is that sometimes what's charming and wonderful about a deli is if you go with some people, you order a bunch of stuff and you can kind of share a lot, get many bites of many things. I think Manny's, the sandwiches are so giant, you really can't, you got to commit.
Right. You can, but they also have not only takeout boxes, but can I tell you, one of the things, again, Chicago being accused of not being a deli town, I'll tell you, having been raised in Chicago my entire life, but having gone to many of the iconic delis, for example, in New York, Manny's does not have a split charge. A lot of those touristy restaurants charge you a split charge. And our big, giant deli sandwiches, they don't charge a split charge. That's a big deal.
So you can order one sandwich and have lunch and dinner.
Right, exactly. And share.
Right. Done. Nice. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate all of this. And this is a great story. If you follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and tweet this story out after so all of you can get this wonderful list that Louisa Chu made for us. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you. All right. So we're going to take a little break and then we're going to get you to news, all that good stuff. So back here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. I hope you are all bundled up and cozy wherever it is you're listening from today. So still lots to do on the second half of the show. And, you know, if you are a Twitter user, no doubt you have. It has been a very interesting place from the start, but certainly in the last year. And in the last week, it has been even more interesting because there have been some platform changes. And any time there are platform changes, people get very upset. We are programmed to not enjoy change very much as a people. I remember when Facebook changed the font of the Facebook logo, people lost their minds and thought they were going to abandon Facebook and all of these things. So this comes up a lot anytime there's change. But I will be the first to admit that this latest round of changes is a little different and it feels kind of weird. I'll be the first to admit. So joining us, we've hauled in an expert. We are joined by Kara Carroll, who does many, many things. She's a web developer. She's a community organizer. She knows she is your go-to tech person for sure. And we're going to talk with her about changing Twitter. Kara, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Kara. So Twitter is changing the rules on us a little bit. For the longest, we've had this 140 character limit, and it worked so well because we had no choice but to kind of distill our thoughts down to the absolute marrow of the idea. But suddenly we have 280 characters. How are you feeling about that?
I have a few complicated feelings about it. You know, Twitter started out as a service that was pinned down to an SMS service. So that's kind of where the 140 characters came from. So as they've expanded, they don't really have that kind of constraint anymore. So seeing that as not something that they have to really think about, you know, I can see how they've got through, you know, allowing people to have more capacity for speaking their mind on the platform. But I don't know. I really appreciated the brevity of the medium. And I think a lot of people have as well. And I think that's been a lot of the conversation that's gone on in terms of being able to have so many more characters to say more things when, you know, it's really allowed for people to become better writers or become, you know, more succinct communicators. So I think that there's kind of a loss in terms of that. But I guess, you know, we'll see how it works. I think with any feature that has been brought on in all the platforms, just as you mentioned with Facebook as well, you know, we don't like it. We are frustrated about it. There's different kinds of ramifications for those changes, but eventually people move on to, you know, utilizing the service as they always had.
Right, right. Eventually we adapt or we get mad about something else. You know, I agree with you. I think I liked the brevity too. And I think the interesting thing we've seen on Twitter over the last, say, 6 or 8 months or so has been the habit of making threads. And that is simply you send the first tweet and then you start adding second and third tweets to the bottom of it so that if someone wants to click through and read a longer string of thoughts, they can do so, but they're also free to ignore it. So when the 280 character limit rolled out, I opened my, you know, opened my phone and looked or opened the Twitter app and scrolled through my feed. And it was so long. It felt, you know, I will commit and sit down and read a paper or a book, but something about sitting there and, you know, what worked about Twitter for me was my ability to scan a lot of information quickly and stop and read deeply where I wanted to. And now it feels like I don't have a choice in a way.
Right. I think that's been interesting seeing how people have taken to modifying their work to the fact that they have now 280 characters to work with, you know, either by utilizing more space
in terms of, like, you know, new lines, breaking up the content, or just putting out walls of text. I know I've definitely felt an increased frustration looking at tweets and seeing, you know, the full use. I've seen people say that they were still going to adhere to a shorter character count with the tweets that they make. And I think that threads, as you mentioned, are really useful for being able to take little chunks of information. And though you're reading, you know, what could end up being, you know, 5 to 40 different tweets, you know, it really allows you to go through the narrative in much clearer, succinct points, as opposed to getting walls of text where you're expected to just, you know, have that much attention in one space for one time. Yeah, we'll see how it goes. But I think one thing I've definitely appreciated is seeing the way that people have been creative with utilizing the 280 characters, with creating games like Connect Four, or mm-hmm. playing chess with other characters, with other Twitter followers. I think that's been an interesting take on utilizing the character count.
Right. I think it'll be interesting to see what it will do socially and culturally on Twitter. I mean, I think it'd be easy to say that won't have an impact. I think it will. You know, Twitter is such an interesting and essential organizing platform. We have seen so many moments in the last handful of years in which the role of social media played such an essential part. I mean, when everything began to happen in Ferguson, before journalists could get there, the stories emerged because Twitter and because of video, because people were able to pull out their smartphones and get live video of what was happening there. We saw this, we've seen this around the world. Arab Spring had, like, social media had a huge role there, particularly Twitter. So I think it'd be interesting to see, will it make it seem like it's moving slower? Will it do something in that regard? It remains to be seen. But I immediately, when I, you know, I'm always thinking about the social impact of things. And so immediately when I saw that change, I had that question immediately come to mind.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that, we'll see how that also might change in terms of the way that different factions of our community utilizes the platform, in terms of the way, you know, journalists use that to, you know, deliver larger news pieces, or, you know, will we see other kinds of industries utilizing that for being able to kind of, like, report on what's going on within the companies or organizations or moments that they're having. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I wonder too, you know, we talk so much about civility online and how sometimes it's really, we tend to pre-censor ourselves, anticipating that kind of blowback from social media platforms. So I wonder about that too. Mm-hmm. Now we've just given, perhaps not the most polite people a bigger stage in many cases, which brings me to my next thing I want to ask you about, Kara. And that is mm-hmm. Twitter's verification program. Kind of a mess from the start, because it was pretty much shrouded in mystery. You know, it was this elusive blue check mark that initially meant your identity has been verified and perhaps you had a little bit extra layer of security. A lot of journalists were given that just because it was a lot of people tried to, you know, hack journalists' Twitter accounts and politicians and things like that. And so somewhere along the line, it became about importance and being, you know, people got excited when they got verified, as opposed to, you know, I've submitted the paperwork that I need. So, I mean, and I say that myself, I have a blue check mark and I got that when a lot of journalists were getting verified. But Twitter has suspended mm-hmm. that right now because it is really mired in a lot of, there's a lot of controversy going on the heels of Charlottesville, all these kind of hate groups using Twitter also as an organizing platform. So Twitter has recently verified one of the people who organized the white supremacy rally in Charlottesville, and that created huge outcry. And then immediately Twitter suspended that. And there's been a lot of celebrities and athletes, a lot of people are, and just regular citizens too, really up in arms about that part. So kind of talk us through that a bit too.
Yeah. So this is something that had come across my, you know, timeline in terms of the conversations that are going on with who can be verified and who are not, who are still being verified and who are not. And I think, yeah, a lot of this presumption is that people are only getting verified if they, you know, just have some kind of large following. But there's also this larger gray area for, like, is it that you are more popular or that you have some kind of larger, you know, influence on the larger, you know, spectrum of the work that you're doing. And there's been a lot of reports from folks who you would think that should be able to have some kind of blue check mark or valid verification of their identity that have not been able to do that. It's a lot of folks who have tried to go through that process several times, have been denied. And the ironic thing is that although Twitter had talked about it as being a system for, you know, validating that a person is in fact who they say they are, but they are utilizing a lot more factors for that, in that not just being identifying that person, but also checking whether or not they're putting some kind of value on that person's identity as a part of Twitter as a whole.
Right, right.
So I think it's really unfortunate, and I'm glad that they're, you know, stepping back and thinking through their systems, but I feel like with many things that Twitter brings on, it's a little, you know, too little too late. And we'll see what they, you know, end up implementing in terms of kind of rectifying the issues that they have with this verification system. But I think right now it's really... they're just really not putting themselves in a good position.
Right. I agree. And it seems like along the way, verification became conflated with a personal endorsement from Twitter. So I think when those two things melded in users' minds, I think when we saw people who were even controversial figures, much less members of hate groups and things like that, when we saw those people getting this blue check mark of endorsement, that's when, you know, understandably so, a lot of people got really, really upset and confused by that. To me, it seems like there's another story here, and that is there is so much conversation about allowing hate speech on Twitter and kind of this narrative arc of the right to say anything you want and free speech and all that, but then also having people, I don't know, relatively absolved of responsibility for doing so. And so we have, you know, a really interesting and kind of non-stance from Twitter, in a sense. CEO Jack Dorsey has come under a lot of fire, and in many cases, rightly so, for really kind of taking a non-position on this and really not doing much to, you know, to protect the safety of a lot of people on the platform. So many really horrible instances that we've seen in the news over the last several years have occurred because of really violent behavior and threats and things like that over Twitter. So I think that moment we're in, too, is a really interesting one. And I think Twitter at some point is going to have to be forced to make a decision about where they fall on hate speech and threats and things like that, just because they're, you know, you can block someone, but they're still. To me, anyway, there's a difference between someone calling you a jerk and saying, I'm going to block them because they're rude, versus someone threatening your life and things that, in fact, happen every day on Twitter.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Twitter has thought that putting a neutral stance on something is being, you know, neutral, but in reality, the systematic way that they have given rights and reference to some folks and discrimination and blocking other folks is just proven the fact that they are really not taking a neutral stance. And at this point, they're trying to just not say the wrong thing, quote unquote. And I think that that's really what they need to start realizing. A lot of the work that they're doing to take on harassment and being able to, you know, amplify folks that need to be blocked. You know, I think a lot of it has been coming from the perspective of their, you know, the idea that they are revenue generating as they're trying to make sure that they are keeping people that are keeping their business alive happy, but they need to think about the larger ramifications for what that means as a larger platform for, you know, public communication, and they need to kind of like get their, you know, things in order to see what should they prioritize over, like, revenue over, you know, this being a public space for communication.
Right, certainly. Yeah, I agree. I think it's a really interesting time on Twitter. And I mean, a couple of years ago, when they had very high turnover at senior leadership levels, we saw a blog post that came out from an HR leader who, and she said, you know, here is our demographic data. We're not doing a good job. It is a very homogenous workforce here. We're not representing our users very well. We're going to fix this. Please hold us accountable. Shortly after, that woman no longer works there, and she was replaced by somebody, I think, from Apple. So we see, Twitter has been under fire for kind of being this stronghold of really this very homogenous workforce in a very homogenous place of Silicon Valley anyway. And I think this is just yet another example of where we're seeing how that really plays out as a very problematic issue.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we have examples of folks who have also left Twitter that were on their engineering team, you know, that had been there, that have made public statements that they had made things known that things were problematic in terms of, you know, who they're, you know, allowing on Twitter, who they are, you know, removing from Twitter and that kind of thing. And just having that clarity from the inside, from a person saying, you know, this was known, this is something that I have reported, and this obvious that this is not something that that Twitter has still taken the time to deal with, you know, it just makes it a lot more, like, glaringly obvious that this is not an issue that Twitter wants to deal with or has the capacity to, given the demographic of folks that they have working for them and their inability to address that issue head on, regardless of, you know, the few, you know, C-suite type folks that they've brought on to kind of deal with, you know, diversity and inclusion or right. dealing with, you know, kind of trying to make those changes with their recruitment and retention. It really just one of the quotes that the tweets that somebody had mentioned that I thought really speaks to what's going on is somebody mentioning, this is Twitter reorganizing its closet the night before finals. Like, they're trying to bring out all these different types of features that, like, oh, you know, we're trying to do some things here. We're trying to keep it fresh.
Yeah.
In reality, you know, you're just hiding all of the skeletons in your closet that we know are there.
Yeah.
And you're refusing to address them. And I think people are just getting tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we will really, you know, continue to see how Twitter, you know, continues or tries to address these issues more head on, listens to their users instead of thinking about how they're thinking about Twitter as, like, a business,
yeah.
you know, which is still, you know, something they have to do valid. But, you know, one of the big, you know, necessities for being a business is that you're listening to your users, right?
Right.
And I think that the further they ignore those kinds of voices, you know, the further away we'll get from seeing Twitter as something that that people continue using. You know, we've seen the growth of platforms like Mastodon and mm-hmm. other calls to, you know, make mass exodus from Twitter, and I think that those are becoming a lot more real threats to Twitter.
Yeah.
Besides the fact that there's such a large amount of user base that Twitter has, there's only so much that people can tolerate when it
True.
Comes to their safety
yeah.
and, you know, their own sanity when it
right,
comes to
right.
being able to have public communications.
I know. I mean, I express all this dismay, and yet I know many wonderful things have happened in my own life because of Twitter. I've made great friends. I've gone to networking
really?
Events. I was hired to the Chicago Tribune because of Twitter, right? There's lots of things that I can definitely point to that's, and I know tons of people with stories like that that say Twitter's done a lot of things and connected me with a lot of people. So there's that. And you know, we love it, but yet they need to get their act together for sure. I love the way you put it about the organizing the closet the night before finals. I think that's really wonderfully put and well said. So it'll be interesting, especially as we, there was just a piece in Bloomberg recently about Written by Max Chafkin, who is also a contributor to this program, about how Snapchat has really managed to bypass all of the fake news issues because they keep their commentary and their news completely separate, and they employ journalists, whereas Facebook and Twitter has been so mired in the spread of misinformation. So I think Snapchat is a really interesting platform to that we have to take very seriously and we have to be thinking about too. So that'll all be very interesting. So Kara, what big stories in the tech realm are you keeping an eye on in the week ahead, and what should we be looking at?
In terms of Twitter specifically,
or anything, just you are in it. You're on top of all things. So,
I think
because we've gotten through the big iPhone announcements for now, we've seen some big changes from Twitter. So I wonder, is there anything else we should be watching, or is it just going to be more of the latest from Twitter?
One thing that I have noticed, I think that you spoke a little bit about like the idea that Snapchat is doing things right. I think that part of it is that they've seen what's come out of these previous platforms. So I think that, you know, keeping an eye on, you know, their continued development is useful. Musically, if you haven't heard of that platform, just recently got, they got acquired or purchased for about $1 billion music.
That'll work.
Yeah, that is a platform that is, you know, very targeted to much younger demographic. Mm-hmm. It's basically a video community, and you know, they've been purchased for, I want to say, $1 billion dollars. So that's, you know, definitely a different platform that not many people are on, or that is being seen as like mainstream. But it'll be interesting to see more platforms that are coming out that are hopefully learning from the different ways that Twitter and Facebook have like come about and had to deal with their platform being such a public space, and how they may deal with harassment and you know, ways of keeping their users safe, especially as a platform that's holding such a young demographic.
Right, right. Well, I think that's, at this point, I think ignore the human part of social platforms at your own peril, really. You know, I think it's very real issues of bullying and harassment and abuse and threats and things like that. That's so very real. So, I hope other platforms and new emerging technology platforms are paying attention to what some of these tech giants have done well or done poorly. I think probably you can learn more from what they've done poorly, but nonetheless. Mm-hmm. Well, Kara Carroll, thank you so much for being with us today. Web developer, community organizer, all things tech. Whenever we have a question, what's going on? What is this? What do? We talk with you about it. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right. So we are going to take a little break. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.
This is 720 WGN Chicago.